And good morning, good evening,
another
good afternoon.
Great start. Good job, Chad.
Welcome to HoopsHD.com. I'm your host, Chad Sherwood, joined first of all by David Griggs over there, and second of all by a special guest tonight for our podcast, Andy Schwartz from the HBL. Andy, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Great. Thanks for joining us tonight. And this, we have a special show tonight. We want to talk about a new entity that's coming up here, I believe, trying to get this off started next year or the year after.
June 2020 is our current target date.
Okay, June 2020. So we're about a little under 2 years away from the start of it, the HBL. But Andy, before we get to the HBL.
The shirt.
For those people that don't know, well, let's start with the shirt. Okay, David. Yeah. You got to see your shirt, Andy.
Yeah, I'll get my shirt here.
Yeah, amateurism is a con. All right, so in HBL logo.
Yeah, I mean, people always talk about the difference between amateurism and pro, but we think it's more con.
Well, the thing about college basketball these days is that it's sort of both amateur and pro because they don't get paid, but they can be fired.
Yeah.
So there, true. I mean, it's only half amateur.
I mean, the thing is that they do get paid. They just get paid a fixed amount, right? A college
zero.
Scholarship is not zero. Yeah. They get checks for cost of attendance.
Yeah.
And so it's really not amateur. What it is price fixed.
Yeah.
Well, Andy, well, before we can get a little bit more into it, Andy, I guess with the people that aren't familiar with you, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your background? And then I definitely want to hit into this HBL, though, and this whole amateurism versus pro issue.
Sure. I am an antitrust economist, so you'll hear econ buzzwords from time to time. What I primarily do for my day job is I help lawyers who are suing other people in antitrust cases. Antitrust is about competition. If you're being sued, maybe because it's alleged that you have coordinated with your competitors to set the price, you might hire an economist to help you explain either, no, it didn't happen, and here's the pricing evidence to show that our prices weren't going together. Or conversely, if you're suing somebody, you might sue, hey, look, here's the evidence that it did happen, and here is what would have happened if you hadn't fixed the prices. And so the way that segues into sports economics, which I sort of focus on, not as my sole focus, but as one of them, is that almost every sports league that's out there consists of multiple independent businesses getting together and making arrangements of one sort or another that if they weren't sports companies, if they were, cafes, it would be illegal. Like when the Cowboys and the Redskins agree that they're going to produce a game on a certain day at Jerry World, that would probably be illegal if two steel mills agreed to when they were and weren't going to produce steel. But obviously for a sports event to happen, you need to have agreements. And so that nuance creates a lot of work for antitrust economists to show in sports that a particular agreement either is or isn't anti-competitive. And where it then segues into college sports is that the NCAA, especially when you think about football, its primary purpose in football is to make sure that everyone pays the same thing, which if you said that about any other industry, there's a group out there, it doesn't hire referees, it doesn't set schedules, it doesn't have TV contracts, it just makes sure that everyone gets paid the same amount. You would go to jail for that probably as criminal price fixing, or certainly under the civil law, you would pay a hefty, treble damages for price fixing. But we have cases that are outstanding. In fact, one goes to trial on September 4th. The court has not found that yet to be price fixing.
Real quick, Andy, just a quick question. Are you a college sports football and basketball fan as far as what is going on between the lines? I mean, I know Yes. You have a lot of problems with the structure, but would you sit and watch a football or basketball game and enjoy it and root for one of the teams, or are you just more?
No, I am a big fan, and the way I see this is that my economics is trying to save college sports from its criminality.
Okay.
Well, and Andy, I think that's where we tie into the historical basketball league, the HBL, that you are part of the founding team of that's trying to get this league up and running. And the idea here is to, I believe, to present an alternative model to what the NCAA is. Am I correct?
Yes. The idea, there's a fundamental question, which is the reason that people like college sports because the athletes are collegians engaged in sport, or the reason that people like college sports is because they are kept artificially underpaid? The NCAA view is that the driver of the popularity is the enforced poverty, that you don't watch it because you like Auburn and Alabama. You watch it because the players on Auburn and Alabama would earn more if they weren't price fixing, but because they don't, you're like, yeah, I want to go watch it. So it's sort of like almost like the flip side of fair trade coffee. Fair trade coffee, the idea is people will pay more to find out that the workers were paid fairly. In college sports, the theory is, the NCAA theory is, that people watch to make sure that the college players aren't paid fairly. And we think it's the opposite. We think that what makes people like college sports is college sports, and that the money has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, there is a school of thought out there that it's just almost this false morality of, oh, they're doing it for the love of the game, and I don't want to watch it if they're playing for anything more than the love of the game. And you just want to say to somebody like that, well, I mean, at least in my own personal experience, if you paid me money, I wouldn't love you any less.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are certain people that would maybe love you more, but I think the thing is that people have been fed that line, and the best way you can think about it is the Olympics, right? So Avery Brundage ran the USOC and forever, and said that, for example, well, college sports isn't really amateur. They're not playing for the love of the game because they get scholarships, and they wouldn't even go to those schools probably if they didn't get a scholarship. So how much love is there? There's a lot of payment there. But everyone was told that no one would watch the Olympics anymore if the athletes were paid. And then the dream team came and everyone was like, wow, this is really fun. I want to watch it. So, and I can tick off other things. In the 19th century, I'm a historian as well. In the 19th century, amateur baseball was the only way to do it. And the Cincinnati Reds, the team that became the Cincinnati Reds, started paying their players. And all the successful teams said, oh, this will kill the sport. No one will watch baseball if it's not played for gentlemanly love of the game. And, you know, needless to say, there are more people watching baseball now than in 1876. Tennis was supposed to be amateur until 1968. So if you played at Wimbledon, you had to be amateur. The U.S. Open, the reason it's called the Open, and is that it used to be the U.S. Amateur, and they still have the U.S. Amateur. But then they made a tournament that was open to all competitors, and that proved to be more popular. So I can go through it, and there are other sports that you can point to. But what there's never been is, there's never been a league that said, you know what we need to do to make people like our sport more is stop paying the players so that they'll be playing for the love of the game. That'll really boost ratings.
Well, I'll tell you, Andy, for me personally, what I love seeing is a good game between good teams, and, you know, and rooting for the schools that I like, and rooting for either for the local school or the school you went to. I don't see anywhere that money, whether the players are getting played or not, factors into that. And like you said, you get a better product when you put the dream team out there, don't you? You get a better product when you put professional tennis players in there.
I mean, I agree. If you read a survey and you want to rig it so that people will say we love amateurism, you can do it. You can ask questions like, and you can, I mean, there's two pieces to it. You can just do this without, I'm going to talk about racism in a minute, so prepare yourselves.
Okay.
You can do it without bringing in racism by just asking questions like, do you think it would be better if college athletes played for the love of the game versus for a paycheck, right? If you ask a question like that, you're rigging it. You're putting a valence on things, so people say, oh yeah, of course they should play for the love of the game. But if you ask it like, let's say you have a ticket to the national championship game on the 50-yard line, and you find out before the game that the winning team is going to get $100,000 a player, are you going to give away your ticket? Probably not. And so like, the question of like, what do you feel versus how will you consume, I'm being an economist again, how will you consume the product? People's consumption patterns don't change. People love to grumble about how overpaid baseball players are, but people who like baseball still go to baseball games. And you can say, well, baseball's declined over time, but that's because it's a slow and boring sport, not because the athletes are paid a lot.
And isn't what they're being paid, you're being an economist, it's a factor of what the media contracts and what the ticket sales and the like are. Is it? I mean, yeah. The money is, they're not going to pay these guys this money if the teams can't be making money, right?
Right, and it's important. A lot of people think that what happens is they decide how much to pay the players and they go to the network and they say, well, we're paying the players in total $100 million, so we need $120 million. And then they go to the ticket people and they say, we need you to pay more for tickets. That's reversed. For over 200 years, economists have understood that it isn't that land is expensive, so crops sell for a lot of money that you need to grow on the land. It's that people will pay a lot for food, and so as a result, the things that you need to make food, like land, go up in price. And the baseball version, the sport version is, people will pay a lot to watch great athletes play sports, and once they've gotten unions and been able to demand their fair share, pay has gone up. So athletes are like land. They only have value if you're growing crops that people want.
Yeah. I did have a comment, Andy, and I'll let you expand on this. I thought it was interesting that you were working with the HBCUs, either – I don't know if it was exclusively, but that was who you were targeting, because these are schools with rather rich sports histories, but at the same time, especially in basketball, even by mid and low major standards, kind of lag behind. But they have really, like, devout alumni groups or bases, a lot of them, and they have – at least in football, and in a lot of cases basketball, sort of a rich sports history. How did you sort of land on working with them?
Yeah, so I would recommend to anybody, if you have a chance, to go to Atlanta for the Celebration Bowl, which is now sort of the HBCUs, I think, have opted out of the FCS playoffs.
And I was actually kind of sorry to see that, yeah.
But play each other, and it's a fun game, and the bands are there, and the fans are really into it, and it's way more – I would imagine that it's going to be a better environment than almost anything other than the very top tier of FBS bowl games. I was in Atlanta for it last year, and I really enjoyed it. Cartel theory. So first of all, when I say cartel, because I'm an economist, I'm not talking about drug deals. A cartel in economics is a group of companies that are independent that get together to fix prices. And when I say fix prices, I mean set them in agreement. It doesn't have to be the same. I could agree that I'm going to charge $10 a pop for my substandard whatever soda, and you're going to charge $20 a case for your good soda. And if we're agreeing, even though they're different prices, we're still fixing prices. So if there were a soda cartel, Coke and Pepsi and RC, and I don't know who else we would put in that thing, would get together, 7-Up, and get together and set prices. That would be a cartel, even if you don't think that sugared soda is a problem. So cartel theory says that, generally speaking, you have a problem because you get the companies together and they all do better in aggregate if they set prices artificially high, but then you have to decide how to divide up the pie. And if you look, the NCAA, which I think is a cartel, they publish the distributions to their cartel members. And if you go through, you'll see that an SEC school gets $4 million from the NCAA, and a school like, say, Morehouse, which is a D2 HBCU, gets about $50,000. So $4 million versus $50,000, you can see who's getting the short end of the stick. And that's just the NCAA money. If you look at conference money, it's more like $40 million for an SEC school in total and like $1 million for a D1 HBCU and less than $100,000 for a D2. HBCU. So there's this, the pecking order of who gets the monopoly profits is skewed against the HBCU. So in theory, you should be able to walk into an HBCU and say, you can do better outside of this cartel. But in practice, and you know, so I'm a naive economist, ivory tower kind of guy. When you go there, it's a much deeper, richer story. You talk to an HBCU and they're like, the affiliation that we have with our conference is very important to us, and that I knew. Yeah. The affiliation that we have with the NCAA is itself important because it establishes us as one of the 351. There are 351 D1 schools, if it's a D1 school.
353 this year, but yeah. North Alabama. Who's the other one? Oh, Cal Baptist, yeah.
Cal Baptist, and what's the other one?
North Alabama.
Thank you. So I should have to update my name. It establishes us as one of the, because there are over 3,000 colleges in the United States, it establishes us as one of the top 10% in some sense. And we've tried to structure our model so they don't have to give up their NCAA affiliation. And I can tell you more about how we do that, but that was a bigger sticking point than I thought at first. And it's one of the reasons why it's taken us a while to get going. But the idea is that you are a community of schools that are specifically, you were founded, most of them were founded, a few were founded before the Civil War. Most were founded right after the Civil War as Jim Crow was kicking in. And schools were like, look, if we're going to take a formerly enslaved population and turn them into fully functioning citizens of our republic, we need to give them fair access to education. And these schools are finding ways not to admit young black men. I mean, and women too, but, you know, society was more back then. And so HBCUs were founded in some sense as a counterweight to the increasingly segregated South. So these were schools that were designed specifically to take black men and women and help them become full citizens of the republic and full participants in our economy. And yet, when it comes to the NCAA, they are essentially working with a group of predominantly white institutions to deny those athletes their full economic rights. So it's not just that they're getting the short end of the financial stick, they're also, their mission and their historical legacy is about stopping the sort of things that the NCAA does, which is extract wealth from black communities and give it to a broad white middle class of athletic directors and coaches.
So the HBAL, are you dealing exclusively with HBCUs, or has there been contact with other schools as well at this point?
So our model is evolving. I would say that the easiest way to say it is that we're not exclusive, but we've set it up in a way that HBCUs are prioritized. So the bulk of our teams are going to be in, you know, HBCUs are really only in the South and in the border states. They're not in California where I am, for example. We hope to have a California team. So the California team is not going to be affiliated with an HBCU, but nevertheless, the nature of our league is going to be such that it will be indelibly imbued with an HBCU vibe.
Okay, and so the idea here then is we take whatever schools you do get to participate, they will be fielding a team that is, for the HBL, that is different from their NCAA team, different group of players, obviously, because you then run into NCAA eligibility issues, which I think...
Right, we would love for our athletes, our games are being played in the summer, so there's nothing that would stop a player who's playing in the HBL in the summer from playing for his varsity team at his school, other than the NCAA rules against it. So we're not in any way, the contract's not exclusive, we're not going to stop them from doing it, but as the rules stand today, they would be ineligible.
Right. So if they played, obviously if they played the year before, that wouldn't be any problem. But
right, and in fact, I think in our starting year, you'll see a lot of people who played, say, their freshman year, they're not a one and doneer, but they're good players, saying, sure, I'll play for the HBL instead. I mean, I'm just going to say it right now. We hope to poach a lot of athletes from the NCAA.
Yeah. I'm just curious. I'm assuming you've reached out to schools, and this might not be a singular answer, but how have you been received? Were they excited about it? Were they like, oh, this is crazy? The schools that you've approached, I mean, I'm assuming you've gotten some positive reception, but like, what's that reception been like?
Yeah. So to my great disappointment, there is no school that has yet permitted me to say their name as a yes school.
Okay.
Because I think everyone is afraid to be the first. And so until we have the full league, or until we have some brave school that wants to go first, I can't say who, but I can tell you generically, yeah, the range of reception has been a guy slapping down his business card at a presentation I made and said, I'm in, president of the university. So that was the best. And all the way down to people refusing to take a meeting with us and even listen. So there's a wide range of things. What I'm really looking forward to is after we're planning to have 12 teams in our first year, I'm looking forward to in year two, the schools complaining that we're not taking their meetings, or why didn't we push harder to get past that gatekeeper, et cetera. I think that that's something that you'll see. So there are fairly young, progressive presidents within HBCUs. And for a university president, young is like my age, like 50. And then there are like 70 or 80 year olds, and you'll see a skew. So it's much easier for us to talk to people born in the 60s and explain why the system isn't working for HBCUs. And this is, you know, HBCUs are in a bit of a crisis. Let's leave aside their athletics, which are a bit in the doldrums.
Yeah.
HBCUs as a whole serve a really, really important role. I think it's something like 25% of all African-Americans who get graduate degrees graduate from HBCUs, even though HBCUs only graduate something like 3% of the graduates in the country. So they are the future advanced degree Black scholars, professionals are coming disproportionately out of the HBCU community, and HBCUs are struggling financially to stay afloat. So we see this as a way to help get the money. I think that once we start doing that, there'll be a bigger clamor for the other schools to join us.
Yeah, and it goes beyond athletics, like you said. We actually, believe it or not, at Hoops HD, we do a podcast once a week during the season where it's called Under the Radar, and we focus on the 22 non-multi-bid leagues, and that certainly includes the MEAC and the SWAC. And it's just some of what these schools go through. I think it was a year or two ago, South Carolina State almost closed. Yeah. One of the schools, Savannah State, has basically – it looks to me that they're basically being bullied by the state of Georgia into reclassifying for reasons that are total nonsense. When you look at, like – what they're stating financially, they're not going to save any money by going to Division II, and the enrollment's down, and they're just not being funded or valued the way that they should be. And I'm not speaking in terms of athletics. Athletics is a part of it, but as institutions in general, it is frustrating because of what you just said, how important these institutions are.
Yeah. So D2 in sports economics world, we call D2 Death Valley.
Yeah,
because it has nearly the same expenses as D1 and nowhere near the revenues. So if I were going to start a sport on a school, I'd probably do D3 because you can make tons of money charging kids to play sports for you instead of paying them, because people like to play sports at the college level. But if I really wanted to make money, I would have a D1 team and I would get my check from the NCAA for $1 million a year. And so I would hope that if the state of Georgia is doing that, that somebody who knows what's going on, there's a real problem relying on athletic department accounting because it confuses transfer payments within the university with real expenses. If I double the list price of tuition, then my athletic department suddenly looks like it's losing twice as much money on scholarships. But if those are scholarships that are going to people that wouldn't otherwise come and wouldn't be replaced by some other one because you're at chronic unenrollment, under-enrollment, which is an HBCU problem, not all HBCUs, but many HBCUs have empty space. Those scholarships are effectively free to give away. And if you're giving out a 50% scholarship, say, to somebody in a non-counter sport, that's like a 50% coupon. But if you're getting half the revenue, none of that revenue shows up on the books. It looks like it's costing you when it's making you money. And I've done papers. I've shown that women's bowling made money at UAB before they canceled it. Bad mistake.
Yeah, and I remember reading a couple things that you wrote about UAB. I think they cut football and was it two other sports? Was bowling one of them? I forget. But bowling and rifle. And it was just fascinating to see because one of the points you made, and this isn't something that a lot of people understand, is that it doesn't cost $20,000 to write yourself a check for $20,000. And money that doesn't leave the university really isn't money lost by the university. If the athletic department is, even if it's being subsidized, if it's writing checks to the general fund that cover the scholarships, then it's not really costing the school anything to do that, especially if it's a school like UAB or the HBCUs, in this case, that are trying to grow their enrollment.
Yeah. So in economics, we talk about this idea of opportunity cost, and it's a little bit mystical. But the short version is, if you're not kicking anybody else out to make room for the athlete, then there's very little cost in getting a scholarship. And if you are kicking somebody out, then the real cost, because they're going to, one person getting educated versus another person getting educated is going to cost the same, then the real cost is really how much revenue was that other person that you kicked out going to pay you. That's the opportunity cost. But right. for a school that's chronically under-enrolled, you're not kicking anybody out. So the analogy that I often give is, like, imagine that you have an adult child, which I do, and he lives with you, which he does, and you were to charge him rent, which I don't. But if you charged him rent of, say, $1,000 a month and he were unemployed, which he is, then you gave him $1,000 subsidy to cover it, right? It'd be a big
round. Can I move in?
Yeah, you can move in. Well, we have three kids. Our daughter is a fine, upstanding individual, and she has two jobs, and she's living on her own. Okay. Our two sons, layabouts, staying with us at home. If I charge him $1,000 and I give him $1,000, it's no different than if I charge him none. If I double the rent, so it's $2,000, and I double the subsidy, it's $2,000. Nothing has changed except if I do a accounting for one of my sons and I say that they have now $2,000 of expenses. They're like, oh my God, he's costing you so much money, but I'm paying myself.
Yeah.
He hasn't changed what it costs at all. But college sports accounting treats that increase as a real cost when it's fake.
Right. Well, and you know why that is. I'm sure you do, because these are nonprofit. You basically have to show a balance of zero or less.
I can agree to that in part. And I don't know if it's worth fighting over the part that I don't agree with, but.
Well, okay. Let me rephrase, Andy. That's the mentality of a lot of schools.
That is true.
That's what I was getting at.
We are going to spend every penny that we are given, because it's use it or lose it. And even at a school like, so the University of Florida, for example, their athletic department is sort of a standalone entity, and that's not the important part. They are mandated in some sense to give money to the general fund of the university to turn a profit. So they every year give a check for exactly $6 million to the school. I don't know how they sit it on $6 million. My hunch is they've been told if it's less than $6 million, you're in trouble. But miraculously, the minimum becomes the maximum, which is that once they're told they must give $6 million, they don't give $7 million. And you don't get more kudos for the extra $1 million. So, gosh, I could turn it over to the state and they might spend it on something like education or, I don't know, funding for the poor, or I could spend it on neat locker rooms and improving my standard of living as an athletic director or as a coach, or print up some more, you know, like, let's send 7,000 letters to the same athlete to show him how much we love him. And so there is a strong incentive for the people involved in the sports program to only generate as much profit as required. And if the school says zero, they'll turn a zero profit. If the school says $6 million, they won't turn a $10 million profit.
Well, Andy, look, I want to turn back a little bit over to the HBL here. We're talking about 2 years away from the start of it. And you can see you kind of touched this a little bit. Has there been any brushback against this by the NCAA itself? You know, have you encountered that? Have they been upset about the idea of, hey, you're going to have kids going to schools and you're going to be paying them to play a sport?
Well, so I don't have talking points in front of me, but I can imagine them. The talking points answer is, what do the taxi companies think about Uber? Because that's how we sort of see ourselves, absent the managerial problems at Uber. Maybe we're Lyft. We care because our constituents care, in that I don't want to partner with an HBCU in a way that puts their relationship with the NCAA at risk. But I don't care what the people in Indianapolis think at all about what we're doing. And in fact, if you take their rhetoric at face value, which is that no one wants to watch paid collegians, then we're not a threat to them at all. We're going to come in over the course of the recruiting class that will lead into the 2020 season. So I don't know how you want to describe that. The people graduating from high school at the end of 2020. And we're going to start offering them $50,000 to $100,000 and full sneaker rights of their own and the ability to commercialize their image. And I'm hoping that we're going to take athletes away from Duke and North Carolina and Kentucky. And then I think we'll find out what they think. For now, it's sort of been a benign neglect, and that's fine. I don't need their approval, but
well, maybe that's your bigger risk then, is not the NCAA going back against you, but Duke and Kentucky and North Carolina coming back and saying, hey, what are you doing to us?
Well, what are they going to do, pay their players? Because if so, then we win. That's our – right? I mean, the reason that the HBL exists is not for me to make money, because I certainly haven't. And you can see from the way I charge rent to my kids that I'm obviously not a very good economist. But the reason that the HBL exists is to empower athletes to get their rightful spot in the ecosphere of college sports. And so if we lose the recruiting battle because a price war breaks out and college sports evolves into the 21st century and compensates their athletes fairly and we don't succeed, then, you know, these hats, which are available on our website, by the way, hbleague.com, will be a nice memento of, like, you know, a little bit like Kurt Flood. Kurt Flood changed baseball and didn't make any money out of it. I wouldn't mind if the HBL is remembered as the Kurt Flood of college sports, but I think it's going to be very difficult. I think it's very difficult for the ACC to be in court, for example, and say, the reason that people like our sport is amateurism. And then the moment they lose two athletes, to say, oh, screw amateurism. I think they're going to give us 5 years. And I think 5 years is enough for us to build a brand where everyone goes, I love watching HBL basketball every summer. It fills a really nice niche between when the NBA finals end and when college football starts around Labor Day. It fits right in there, and it's good basketball. And these guys, they're all drafted into the NBA, or they go play high-level basketball in Europe. So it's really like it's on a game-by-game basis. You don't see Elon playing Duke and Presbyterian playing North Carolina. You see Duke and North Carolina, but it's every game. It's Atlanta versus Charlotte or whatever. But it's high-quality ball. And if they wait 5 years, I think they'll find it's too late to stop.
Have you thought about coaching or any sort of league office or how you're going to build that in venues? I would assume you would just use the regular college venue.
Yeah, or if we're not in a college, we don't want a high school gym. Like, so Fisk University, for example. University was founded in 1866, so it's one of the oldest HBCUs. The gym is from like 1867. And
I've not been there, but I'll take your word.
It's not quite that old, but it's charming.
Okay.
It's like got good bones, and it's small, and so it rocks. But that's what we really want, is that this is, again, it's the 21st century. This is going to be a product that we want consumed primarily nationally on a screen. And we want it to be sold out. So if you've, and I don't want to say anything bad about LeVar Ball. I think what he's doing is trying to get at the problem, and I think there are things that I would do differently than he is, but more power if we can all succeed. But one thing that I don't like about what LeVar Ball's league was that the arenas were empty. And the solution to that is to, one, take your time and get there right, and two, play in a right-sized gym. And a small gym – I went to Stanford. Maples Pavilion is not huge, but before our current – doldrums, that place rocked. As long as you can get 4,000 people into Maples Pavilion, it's as good of a home crowd advantage as any place.
That's definitely true. Again, like under the radar, like the Northeast Conference, who you probably don't even know anything about them, but those are great venues, great atmospheres. It's awesome.
Yeah. And so that's what we want in terms of venues. But wait, there was something that you asked me that was only part of the question, right?
I already forgot the question.
You're drug pocket, and I'm.
Oh, coaching. Who do you see as coaches in like the league office and things like that?
Yeah. So and you probably know this better than I am because I'm a basketball fan, but you guys are professionals. We're using NBA rules.
Okay.
NBA three-pointer, shot clock.
Oh, not quarters. Tell me you're not doing quarters. This is a running joke on the code.
Quarters.
Oh.
And 48 minutes. And we're going to use people who want to be NBA coaches, not people who want to be college coaches and who want to run NBA offenses and defenses, because we want to be able to tell our athletes that, first of all, they're going to be on a team with at least a couple other first-round or second-round draft choices, and they're going to be guarding another first-round or second-round draft choice. So every game is going to be a tryout for them for their next step when they want to go to the NBA. And they're not going to be stuck out in a position that doesn't fit them because the college coach wants to win at all costs. They're going to be stuck. They're going to be put in a position that suits them when they're 25, not when they're 19. The coaches we're going to hire are probably going to be guys in the D League. I mean, that's not totally true. There are plenty of people who right now, and actually this fits in with our HBCU mission as well, a lot of them are black coaches. They're stuck being the assistant coach to somebody forever. It's hard for them to get a shot. They get to be the ones who get indicted by the FBI. We're paying players under the table. And this is a chance for them to pay players over the table and show their chops. So we might end up being, in fact, people from the end, that's the way that Duke might get us, is they might succeed in hiring away our coaches because they don't have a problem paying coaches a lot of money, as we all know. Yeah. We're going to prepare for there maybe being a little bit of turnover because we hope to develop great coaches and we hope to help them in their career. But we're not going to be able to match those salaries. We think we can beat the offer to the players, and we'll just have to keep finding good coaches.
Well, Andy, now the teams are going to be affiliated with these various schools. Have you envisioned the scenario of somebody who maybe goes and plays two seasons at Duke or Kentucky and says, wait a second, I want to be in the HBL. I want to be making money. I'm not yet ready for the NBA. I got to go transfer. Is that the way that you're envisioning it?
We are working on a way for that not to have to happen, and I'd love to tell you more, but I've been told by Ricky Vellante.
Okay.
So the short answer is we expect to see people, first of all, like not all HBCUs, no HBCU is 100% black, and not there's even one that's not even majority black, but like Xavier University in Louisiana, not the one in Cincinnati, is 30% non-black. So there are people who go to HBCUs and want to get that experience and aren't, you know, like, they're like me, they're not historically black people. So there's nothing to stop them from transferring, but we hope to have a situation in which players don't have to make that choice. That's one of the things that I think, if I describe what the HBL's motto is that we think that false choices, like go pro or get an education, go to this school or play in the HBL, that those false choices are unnecessary. And we're hoping to make it sort of both and get paid and go to school, that sort of thing.
So not to belabor, so you would, if you had your druthers, you'd like to see them be able to play in the HBL and then possibly return to college to continue to play on the NCAA team? Did I understand?
When you say return to college, all of our athletes will be going to college.
Yeah. Return the college ball. I'm sorry.
A varsity team, because we're a club sport, effectively, right? There's nothing about – our athletes will be employees of the HBL, and they have summer jobs, and then they go to school, sort of like probably you were an employee of somebody for the summer, and then you went to school. So I would love for the rules to be that playing on a summer team in the HBL does not end your eligibility to play on the varsity team. Right. If you think about it, like the original reason why schools enforced amateurism was not about pay. It was about ringers. And what a ringer, right? It was about getting a guy who didn't go to college and paying him to come in and basically be like, you're 25 And, you know, you're really good at football. It was football mostly when it started.
Yeah.
And you're a man among boys, and this isn't fair. And, of course, nobody would pay him to come and play unless he was a ringer. Like, it was like there was a perfect correlation between the people who would require pay to do this and the people who weren't real students. But
right.
But for us, like, playing on an HBL team, you're going to be playing against other college students in the summer. It's perfectly fine to play in a pro-am league against pros in the summer and get really good, and then come back and be on your college team. So in terms of, like, oh, it's unfair, that guy played for the HBL, I don't see how that would create an unfair advantage. But as it stands now, it's verboten, and it won't be allowed.
As it is right now, it's unfair because he got money and nobody else got money. Isn't that kind of what it comes down to, the whole problem here?
I try hard to put myself in the shoes of people who believe that stuff, but my brain breaks on those things.
Well, it's kind of, I think it was 1894. Harvard and Yale played in football. I think it was Harvard and Yale. So, yeah, real good history lesson here. I'm not sure the year or the schools, but 75% of the players in the game were being paid, and none of them had anything to do with either school. So it's just, you mentioned ringers. And the other way that the student-athlete term came about, I'm sure you know this, Andy, but it had to do with not having to pay workers' comp to football players.
Another history lesson, and I can almost get the date right, it was the second half of the 30s, so 36, 37, 38, around there. University of Pittsburgh was quite good, and they paid all their players a salary. The new president came in and said, I'm in favor of amateurism. And they started to scale down the pay so that for a given year, the juniors and seniors were making the old pay level, and the sophomore and freshman were making this new lower pay level. And so they went on strike and wouldn't play until they got their pay fixed. The previous year, it was their second year in the Rose Bowl. This is before the Rose Bowl was restricted to the Big Ten and the Pac-12. 12 in back then, but they went to the first Rose Bowl and played, but they wouldn't go to the second Rose Bowl unless they got $250 a piece because it was an extra game. And football was really popular when this was happening, right? That 1894 Harvard game was probably sold out.
Oh yeah, and, I'm sure it was.
Like, there's literally 50 years, 1956 is the first time that there's a nationally enforced scholarship cap in the NCAA. Before that, there was a try in 1948, didn't work. But, you know, you can go all the way back into the 19th century, and the entirety of the first half of the 20th century, and there were no amateurism rules that were nationally enforced. And it was the golden age, the raccoon coat and ginormous stadiums. You know, the big house got built to be a big house because it was filling up with people coming to watch players playing under rules that didn't require amateurism. And so this idea that without amateurism, college sports would just collapse, it's just factually false.
Yep. I guess at the end of the day, that then here, maybe the goal really is with the HBL is to just show, hey, this is all just a bunch of nonsense with the lines that the NCAA has been feeding us here for the last 50 years or so.
That's my goal. It's not my investor's goal. Okay. My investors,
it's funny too, I guess, right?
I mean, and they all recognize that, and this is, so I'm not the CEO. I am an idea guy. And in some sense, I think in the long run, I will be on the board of directors as the person who's like, are we really being true to the mission here, guys? And they'll be like, well, let's make money. And hopefully I'll have enough influence to make sure that we can make money while being true to the influence. Here's how I would pitch it to anybody who's out there. We also have an investor page if you would like to invest. If I told you that you could, for $100,000 an athlete, pay 144 guys, 12 times 12, 12 teams, 12 athletes. So that's $14.4 million, that you could buy all the talent that ESPN is paying the ACC for now and paying way more per year than that. And you could basically jump to the top of the line in terms of getting the most lucrative TV contract. Would you do it? And so from an investor point of view, there is an artificial restraint that prohibits the incumbent monopolist from reacting to price competition from a newcomer. And if you think about the history of sports leagues, like I was a Boston Breakers season ticket holder in 1984 with my dad. The USFL failed for a couple
Thank
reasons.
Thank you. It took me a second to figure out who they were. Thank you.
Sorry. The USFL failed for a couple reasons. One was it was much harder to get on a screen back then because there wasn't streaming. There were only three networks. There really even wasn't like my town didn't even have cable back then. But the other one was that when they started hiring people, they hired Steve Young, Herschel Walker, Doug Flutie. They got a lot of good talent. But the NFL just said, well, we've been underpaying these guys for years. We can afford to double their pay. So they got into like a gunfight and they only had a knife. They got into a money war with the richest sports league in America. And they had a bunch of guys. They had Donald Trump, guys with like fake money. And so they couldn't withstand it. But we have a situation where we're raising venture capital, mostly from Silicon Valley and East Coast people, like tech people and sports people who, you know, so one thing is in some sense, money's easier to get these days. Like there's a pipeline where people recognize that new ideas make money. Whereas maybe in the 80s, it was a little bit like, why isn't IBM doing this? So that's one thing. But the other thing is that our incumbent league is hamstrung in their ability to use the single biggest weapon against us. So, you know, we may not win every recruiting war. There may be a guy who has his heart set on going to Coach K, you know, slapping the floor, being in Cameron. There are a lot of things that we can't offer on day one. We hope to develop those traditions and be a brand that carries recognition. But we think that we can certainly outcompete in terms of do your parents need a better house? And would you like to be able to help them with the house now and not feel like you're a scumbag because of it? And we want to talk to their AAU coaches and say, and we'd like to give you a finder's fee too in a way that doesn't cause you to run into the problems with the Department of Justice. And basically bring above the table and make legal, I think it's legal now, but make clearly legal what has been alleged to be illegal. And so if we can get to that spot, I think we'll make money. But you are right that I personally won't be disappointed if the net effect is that we demonstrate it, like, you know, the ABA, you can see that the ABA, the American Basketball League, which gave us the Pacers and the Nuggets and the Nets and the Spurs, and I'm forgetting one team of the five that are left. But
was it the Clippers? I don't know.
No, but anyway, the Clippers are actually the old Boston Braves.
Oh, okay.
They failed in some sense, right? They were about to go out of business when they merged in, and there were only seven teams left, and only five of them made it. And there's a fun story about the Spirits of St. Louis, how they got paid. But nevertheless, there were a lot of innovations that the ABA brought in to basketball. And it certainly enlivened the game. And so I would say that the ABA, you could say, was a failure. But on this other hand, you know, it brought basketball to towns that didn't have it. It did a lot of the positive things. If we end up having a legacy like that, it'll be a win.
Well, on that note, I guess, Andy, I think anything other final thoughts you have about for those of us, those that are watching and finding out about the HBL for the first time and your hope and this great project you've got going on here 2 years
away. So I think we're going to have a series of announcements over the fall. I'm hoping to. We've got some named investors that we think are going to come out. We'll get some statements about mission, so it won't be quite as vague as I was today. People should look for that. We have a website at hbleague.com, and we sell hats and shirts.
There should be a link to it up there if you're on Hoops HD right now, just right up there. there it is.
And you know, they're very cool. They say amateurism is a con on the back of the hats too.
Okay.
And there's also a page for an investor. And if you're to invest in a startup like this, you need to be an accredited investor. We can't just take anybody. But if you're the kind of person that meets those qualifications, and $25,000 is not like your life savings kind of thing, and you want to get involved. If you'd like to watch college football today, watch college basketball when the season starts, and get rid of that pang of, gosh, I love this sport, but it is kind of produced exploitatively, you know, this is a great way to be part of the solution. And I have to do it in order for me to feel not guilty watching sports starting in a couple weeks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I mean, I'm a fan of this for a couple reasons. One is that I think the HBCUs are being underserved. And I think that, like, college athletes in general, like you said, if this can help demonstrate, because one of the let me back up. One of the basic questions is, if you could pay football and basketball players, if it's allowed, would schools do it? And anybody that answers no to that question is out of their freaking mind. Well, so they're not getting paid what they're worth, because
if schools wouldn't do it, what do you need a rule for?
Right. Yeah. There you go. And I don't think it would hurt the game at all. As you mentioned, there's absolutely no evidence of it. I knew people that when this cost of living stipends went in, saying that it was the end of college basketball, and it wasn't. People would continue to watch. And, yeah, you'd like to see the players get a little something, and maybe, you know, these multi-million dollar coaches and ADs have to give up a little something to get the players.
Yeah, so I worked on the O'Bannon case in my day job, and
we meant to mention that.
and I worked on the case before that in 2006 through 2008 called White v. NCAA, and the White case was about cost of attendance, and you can go through that case and see horror stories about how providing cost of attendance stipends to athletes would make it impossible for fans to distinguish college basketball from pro basketball. And so those colleges, 2015, 16, 17, 18, they were coming into the fourth season now of athletes being able to get them, and pretty much everyone in the Power Five is getting them. And I would ask your fans of your podcast and of college basketball whether they get confused between the Duke North Carolina game and the Charlotte Hornets game. It's ludicrous, and it's the exact same logic as to what would happen if athletes were to get paid now. Like, a super quick, like, labor economics in a nutshell. Like, the reason that prices go up for specialized goods, let's say podcasters, is because there is a podcast out there that thinks that if they pay you more money and you come to them, you will improve their revenue, right? So the idea that a podcast, we'll just keep it generic, would pick a price. I'm going to pay this puppet so much money that nobody wants to listen to watch the podcast anymore, because he's not podcasting for the love of the pod. It doesn't make sense. It would be like, you only raise pay if you think you're going to get more value out of the payment than you're putting in. Because at some point you're like, I can just get some guy off the street. And the reason that schools give scholarships as opposed to just having tryouts on the first day of school is because they think they can make more money letting somebody come to their school at no cost than they can not getting money from the guy, like D3 style, but then the product sucks. And so businesses don't pay people to lower revenue. They pay people to raise revenue. And if you don't understand that, you're going to get yourself into all sorts of crazy things, like saying, like, oh my God, the price will get so high that no one can afford it. Well, who's paying that price if no one can afford it? And so, you know, Yogi Berra economics doesn't really work. The last thing I'll say, because I know that, you know, of the million people that are watching this podcast right now, like 999,000 of them are saying, but what about competitive balance? And if Kentucky can pay, they're going to get the best five freshmen every year. They already do. So there's, like, I mentioned 1956 before. That's the year that the NCAA started enforcing amateur rules. It's also the year that the very first sports economic paper was written by a guy at Chicago, University of Chicago, Simon Rottenberg. And he showed how rules on pay basically don't affect competitive balance. And like, I'm Jewish. So Rabbi Hillel made some comment about, like, all you need to know about the Bible is honor your God and love your neighbor as yourself, and the rest is commentary. And basically, in terms of competitive balance, everything that's been decided since 1956 is just commentary on Simon Rottenberg. Salary caps don't help competitive balance, especially individual salary caps, which is what the GIA cap is. What individual salary caps do is it make it easier for rich teams to afford multiple good players. And so, if anything, they reinforce imbalance. And that's why, for example, when LeBron and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh all went to the Heat, they were able to do so because the individual salary cap was too low and the Heat could afford to buy three first best players. And the best way to enforce competitive balance is to let the market raise LeBron's price sky high so that his teammates, there really is a trade-off, because you get to the point where, gosh, I'm going to have to pay market rates for these guys. I can't afford two LeBrons. But if you push the price of LeBron down to $20 million when he's worth $100 million, hell, I'll take six.
I guess on that note, I do want to, Andy, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. I think it's been a great conversation here. And as you said, take a look at hbleague.com. You can just click the link right up there. Thanks for joining us, Andy. On behalf of David Griggs, any final thoughts over there, David?
No.
Good.
Right. I think I was brilliant all through the show. I don't need to add anything else.
Yeah, I would give, in my professional opinion, I would agree.
Okay, great. Yes.
All right, I'm Chad Sherwood. That's David Griggs. Andy, thanks for joining us. And we'll be back with more podcasts real soon. Keep an eye on the website. Thanks a lot, everyone.